Well, you'll find it helpful, I think, if you turn with me to those verses we read earlier in Luke chapter 8, verse 22 to 25, as we read this story of Jesus calming the storm. I was driving down over the mountain today, and I was coming down seeing the sea, and it struck me, I'm sure there's probably not a congregation in all of the Presbyterian Church that has dealt with the story of Jesus calming the storm probably more than Kilkeel, because I'm sure it's been turned to many times just through the course of ministry, but also, of course, at all of these Harvest of the Sea services, and I'm sure it's a story that you're very, very familiar with. But we've been working through Luke's Gospel in Hill Street over the last year, and I find this one of my favourite stories, one of the most encouraging and insightful stories, I think, in the Gospels, and I wanted just to turn to it with you today for a moment or two together. The situation, I'm sure we know very well. Jesus and his disciples set out across the lake. He falls asleep. This squall descends upon them, and they think they're going to drown. And of course, some of them are experienced fishermen. They know what a dangerous situation is, and they recognize this as one of those dangerous situations. And we know that the Sea of Galilee, of course, is in a bowl, as it were, and the wind comes down in a certain way, and these storms can whip up very, very quickly. But the disciples find themselves in a situation of real threat, and they go to Jesus, and Jesus rebukes the storm, does this amazing thing. He rebukes the storm, he tells it to be still, and it is. It's just greatly calm. And that provides this sort of teaching opportunity for Jesus with the disciples as he asks about their faith. We're going to think about that in a moment. But what is it that we learn? What's the point of this story? What does it teach us? One of the things I think I'm starting to see more and more about the Bible is that all of these little stories that the gospel writers include in their accounts of Jesus are all there for a very particular purpose. They had lots and lots of things from which they could have drawn, lots of stories they could have told, and yet they choose particular ones that all point to particular truths. And this story is included in Matthew and Mark and Luke, and therefore had a particular importance in the gospel writers' minds. I want to say just four simple things about what this tells us today. First of all, Jesus tells us who he is. Jesus tells us who he is. Even today, the idea of a storm implies chaos. It indicates that things are out of control. And that was even more the case at the time of Jesus. A storm was really then the most powerful thing imaginable. It was the most powerful thing that anyone had experienced. And in the Jewish mind, it represented something that was unstable and out of control. It almost also represented sometimes sin and suffering and things like that. In John's picture of heaven, you remember in Revelation, one of the things that we read there is that there's no longer any sea. Maybe you've wondered about that. And the idea is that God has removed all the sources of chaos in his perfect heaven. By the way, I'm not sure that it literally means that there'll be no sea in the new heavens and the new earth. Those of you who just love nothing better than to walk along a beach will be maybe glad about that. But it certainly means that there's no chaos, no evil. And so here is Jesus facing this most powerful threat imaginable. And what happens? Well, he just takes it in his stride. Verse 24 indicates that, doesn't it? He got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. There's no effort involved. He doesn't wave his arms around. He doesn't do any incantations or anything like that. He just speaks. Mark's gospel tells us that he simply says, "Quiet, be still." He's really just saying, "Hush now, calm yourself down." Now, obviously, that is showing us that Jesus has amazing power. We tried to demonstrate that with a couple of liters of water. If you want to this afternoon, I don't imagine there'll be much of a swell, but if you want to go down onto the harbour and shout out to the waves and see if you can make a difference, be my guest, and people will talk about you for weeks. But you know, it's just not something that we could even comprehend doing. This is amazing power that is outside of our experience. But it tells us more than just that Jesus is powerful. It tells us that he is God himself. In the Old Testament, it is the Almighty God who controls the elements, the wind and the waves. We read in Psalm 107, he stilled the storm to a whisper, the waves of the sea were hushed. And we could quote many other places in the Old Testament where the elements of the natural world are at God's disposal. And yet here, it is Jesus who directly commands them. He doesn't call upon God's name to do it, he does it himself. And that's really important. He is saying, I have this power within me, I am God himself. And if the disciples had eyes to see it, they would see that the passenger that they have in their boat, who seems so passive, is really the same God who had led his people through the Red Sea when they left Egypt 2,000 years earlier. I grew up at a time when a Superman was the movie that you went to see if you were able to do that. It was the time the Superman movies were coming out. And one of the interesting things as you look at the Superman films is that as the viewer, you know who Clark Kent really is. You know that this mild-mannered newspaper reporter really is Superman. And part of the joy of watching the film, as it were, is watching the other characters in the movie stumble towards an understanding of who he really is. Well, it's quite like this in Mark's Gospel, in Luke's Gospel, and in the Gospels in general, in fact. We know who Jesus is. And we're watching the disciples sort of stumble towards understanding who he is. And here they don't really see it. The evidence ought to have convinced them, but in verse 25 we see that they're left wondering, who is this who commands the obedience of the wind and the waves? So this tells us who Jesus is. You know, if you're here today and you suspect that Jesus was probably just a very special man. Lots of people think like that. And if you think like that, if you think that he was a great teacher, a marvelous example of humanity, who was in some ways almost just too good for the earth, then I would suggest to you, this shows you that your estimation of him is just way, way too short. He is God, and that changes everything. That changes him from somebody who it might be wise to seek advice from into someone that you must submit to. And Luke is saying to us, look, do you see it yet? Do you see who he is? Because you must deal with him. Jesus shows us who he is. The second thing is, Jesus warns us what's ahead, or warns us what to expect. And what he indicates here is that being a disciple is not all plain sailing. All of these Gospels, of course, were written for a particular group of people. In the first instance, Luke addresses his Gospel to a man called Theophilus. We don't know anything about Theophilus, except that he was a Greek. And at the time that Luke was writing, probably things were starting to get pretty difficult if you were a follower of Jesus. There were a lot of hard times, there was persecution and so on, starting to increase all around the Roman Empire. Now, there's a strand of Christianity around, and you'll find it here in our own country as well, that implies that if we come to Jesus, everything will be smooth. We'll be happy. Maybe we'll find that we will be more wealthy. Maybe we will be more healthy. All of those sorts of things. And yet it seems that all we've got to do is open the Bible and almost read on any page, and we find that there's no ground for that expectation at all. Jesus makes it clear that following him is going to be difficult. And we see it here. You'd be tempted to think, wouldn't you, if you have the Son of God in your boat, well, everything's going to be really, really smooth. This will be the fastest, smoothest, easiest crossing we've ever had. And yet what happens? There's a storm to end all storms. Not only that, but in the middle of the storm, it looks as if Jesus isn't all that bothered about the disciples. They have to go and waken him up. And even then, he doesn't seem to be in too much of a rush. And not only that, but it was actually Jesus who led them there in the first place. It's very clear in verse 22. He says, "Let's go over to the other side of the lake." In other words, they were in this mess because of Jesus. And those early Christians like Theophilus would be so easily able to identify with this. They had set out to follow Jesus, to be obedient to him, and they find themselves facing difficulties, and maybe it seems at times as if Jesus is asleep. And yet Luke is telling us, look what you're to expect here. Jesus said this to his disciples himself. He said in John 15:33, "In this world you will have trouble." Some of you, I imagine, have those lovely little paintings of a beautiful countryside scene or a coastal landscape or whatever it might be, and there's maybe a little Bible verse penned up on the corner, "Be still and know that I am God," or something like that. I don't imagine that many of them have this verse written on them. "In this world you will have trouble." Imagine hanging that over your mantelpiece. And yet it's a promise, isn't it? It's a promise from the Lord. Why is it, you see, we feel as if we would understand the ways of God with us? We sometimes say to God, "God, I'll trust you in this if I could just see a reason for it." And yet, what is it that makes us think we can understand the ways of God? He's so far above us, isn't he? The Bible tells us that. Isaiah 55, he says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts," God says, "neither are your ways my ways," declares the Lord. "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts." You see, he's telling us we're not always going to understand what he's doing with us. One of the things I used to do occasionally as I was a teenager growing up here, was help one of our neighbors dip sheep. It was great, very exciting. Just shows you the very restrictive environment in which I grew up in those days. But you know how it works, I'm sure, better than I do. There was a 5-foot deep trough filled with water and sheep dip, which was just so foul smelling. And one by one, the sheep were just plunged into this. And it was really, really important for them. I think I only really knew that later on, that sheep are susceptible to all sorts of terrible diseases that, if not treated, will really kill them. It will maim them and kill them in a very unpleasant manner. But that's really, really hard to explain to a sheep. And all they knew was that somebody was coming and picking them up and throwing them in and holding their heads under for a couple of seconds. And they must have thought that the shepherd was trying to kill them. And in actual fact, the shepherd was working to save them. And some of us perhaps today, I know the week that this congregation has had, but maybe some of us today feel that the shepherd is being so very harsh with us. And he's taking us places that we don't want to go. And yet the Bible tells us that he's always working to save his children, and to make them more like Jesus, and to wean us off sin just that little bit more, and make us trust him that little bit more. And we won't always understand it. Jesus warns us what's ahead. Third thing, Jesus points us to what he really came to do. One of the things that I'm seeing, I think, more and more about the Bible too, is that the cross is just so central to the whole story, and therefore there are echoes of it just absolutely everywhere. It's not always on the surface, but there is a thread in every part of the scriptures that leads us to the cross. And the gospel writers select and choose these stories in ways that also remind us of what Jesus is coming to do. And this story has a particular parallel in the Old Testament, because in the Old Testament we read about a group of sailors who find themselves in a storm, and it's in the story of Jonah. Now you think of some of the common features of those two stories. Jonah and Jesus were both on a boat and a storm comes upon them. Both were asleep in the storm. In both cases, sailors have to come and waken them. In both cases, there is a miraculous intervention. And in both cases, actually, the sailors end up terrified. And you think, well, maybe that's just a coincidence. And yet the thing is that Jesus says that he is linked to Jonah. He is the true Jonah. In Matthew 12, he is debating with the Pharisees, and he says this. He says, he answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now one greater than Jonah is here." You see, Jesus is saying, I am the one greater than Jonah, the one linked to Jonah, but greater than Jonah. So Jesus saw Jonah's experience as foreshadowing his own experience. And how was that the case? Well, you think, what happened to Jonah? Jonah says to the sailors, "Throw me in so that this storm might cease and you might be saved." And they do that. Jonah's in the fish for 3 days. Now, that doesn't happen to Jesus on this journey, but something even more remarkable does. You see, Jesus is the one who comes to end all storms. He will bring in, he is the one who's going to bring in that chaos-free world that Revelation speaks of, where there is the picture of no sea. And what needs to happen so that that can take place? Well, he is sacrificed so that the storm might cease, you see. He is thrown into the storm so that people like us might be saved. You see, there is one storm that we cannot ride out. We cannot face the storm of God's judgment. We cannot face his wrath and hope to come out the other side. And yet Jesus did. He faced it. He entered it. He soaked it up. The waves of God's judgment broke over him so that for us, there's no storm. And you see, this story points back to the story of Jonah, but it points forward to the cross. And there, Jesus endures the greatest of all storms so that we won't have to. There, the storm of God's anger just engulfs Jesus so that for us there's peace. Do you see how all stories fit into the great story? How the Son of God comes and takes our place so that we might be rescued. And so Jesus is saying here, not only, "Do you see who I am?" He's saying, "Do you see what I've come to do? And for us, do you see what I've done?" This is the heart of what Jesus does. This is where we see his love. We sang it right at the beginning of the service. "Till on that cross, as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied." And you see, we need this. And maybe some of us think, you know, I'm a religious person. Maybe I'm a good Presbyterian. And if I've been an upstanding member of this community, I'll take my chances. And yet we cannot ride out this storm of God's wrath. Only Jesus can. And so we must embrace what he has done for us. And we must allow what he has achieved to be applied to our lives, so that for us, the wrath of God's storm is calmed. That's the third thing. Last thing, Jesus tells us what to do in a storm. In verse 25, Jesus asked the disciples, "Where is your faith?" Now, Jesus talks about faith of the disciples in each of the gospel accounts, but it's recorded a little bit differently for us here in Luke, and it makes a particular point. And what point it makes is it tells us, it challenges us, what we're to do whenever we face difficult circumstances, as we all do from time to time. Jesus says to the disciples, Where is your faith? Now, he's not saying you don't have any faith yet, you're not converted yet, or anything like that. He is saying you've got faith, but where is it? Why are you not using it? You're not putting it into practice. And this is very important. The disciples, you see, had seen lots of things. They'd seen lots of things that Jesus had done. They'd seen him heal the lepers and make the paralyzed man walk and heal the centurion's servant and raise the widow's son from the dead. They had lots and lots of evidence to go on, but they weren't using it. And what Jesus was saying is, you're not making use of what you know about me today in this situation. And this tells us something very important about faith. Sometimes we talk about faith as if it's just a feeling, you know, a feeling that some people have more than others. You know, such and such a person, they've got great faith. Oh, and I don't have so much faith. But this tells us that faith is not a feeling. It's a choice. It's a deliberate action that we do. And it's us choosing to rely on what we know about Jesus. And Jesus is saying to the disciples here, you know lots about me. You've lots of evidence to go on that points to who I really am. So now is the time to really use it and lean on it. You should be, he's saying, you should be allowing what you know of me to shape how you approach this experience. You should have been saying, look, this is tremendously scary. We've not faced anything like this before, but then we've never had anyone like this with us before. This is the one who heals the lepers and makes the paralyzed people walk, raises the dead. We're okay. You see? Applying what we know. Allowing the things that we've become convinced of to give us peace in the face of the storm. And this is so often our problem, isn't it? It's a problem for me, it's a problem for you, I'm sure. We know all these things about Jesus. We believe he's the Son of God. We believe he came into the world and walked among us. We believe that he raised the dead and fed the 5,000 and calmed the storm, that he went to the cross, that he paid for our sin. We believe he rose again. We believe that because of his death and resurrection, all who believe in him can have their sin forgiven, can be made right with God. We believe that all who are right with God go to be with God in eternal bliss forever. We believe that right now Jesus is at the right hand of God and is interceding for us. We believe that he orders all things. We believe that God's purposes are working out for the good of his children in all things. We believe that the very hairs of our heads are numbered. We believe all these things. These are all things that the Bible tells us. And yet sometimes, isn't it true, whenever we face the storm, the challenge, the difficult situation, we forget all that stuff. And we say like the disciples, Jesus, are you sleeping? Do you know what you're doing here? And what this tells us, and it's really hard. What this tells us is that we've got to take the things that we know about Jesus and we've got to apply them to our today and we've got to apply them to our tomorrow. And that's us using faith, you see. And so we face the difficulty and we say, this is not easy. And it's certainly not the way I would have chosen it to be. And it's painful and it's unsettling. But today I know that Jesus is on the throne. I know he's at work within my life. And I know that I'm safe within his hands. And I know that whatever happens, he's going to take me home. So I'm going to face this with my confidence in him. Jesus is telling us how to cope with storms. We take what we know and we apply it to today. You see, he's Lord of the storm. And if you're a Christian today, then you have him. You have him with you. He's in the boat with you, as it were. Let the knowledge of that give you peace. And rejoice that he has faced the storm, the ultimate storm, the storm of God's wrath. That ought to have broken on you. It's broken on him. And so today, you're free. Let's pray together.